The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the fifth reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Vianne reminds Isabel that she must not speak out to Captain Beck as it will endanger their lives. The next day, Isabel goes into town for the meager rations. On the way back, she sees a poster in an alley and takes the chalk she found and draws a large V on it. A man grabs her and takes her to a room with other members of the resistance and asks if she will join them to distribute flyers. She agrees and sets out and delivers them all through the town. During the long, hot summer, Vianne and Isabel settle into a routine of farm chores. Now we continue with The Nightingale. Her chores were necessary, of course, a new way of preparing for a winter that seemed far away but would arrive like an unwanted guest on the worst possible day. More important, it kept Vianne's mind occupied. When she was working in her garden or boiling strawberries for preserves or pickling cucumbers, she wasn't thinking of Antoine and how long it had been since she'd heard from him. It was the uncertainty that gnawed at her. Was he a prisoner of war? Was he wounded somewhere? Dead? Or would she look up one day and see him walking up this road, smiling? Missing him, longing for him, worrying about him. Those were her nighttime journeys. In a world now laden with bad news and silence, the one bit of good news was that Captain Beck had spent much of the summer away on one campaign or another. In his absence, the household settled into a routine of sorts. Isabel did all that was asked of her without complaint. It was October now and chilly. Vianne found herself distracted as she walked home from school with Sophie. She could feel that one of her heels was coming loose. It made her slightly unsteady. Her black kidskin Oxfords weren't made for the kind of everyday use to which they'd been put in the past few months. The sole was beginning to pull away at the toe, which often caused her to trip. The worry about replacing things like shoes was never far away. A ration card did not mean there were shoes or food to be bought. Vianne kept one hand on Sophie's shoulder, both to steady her gait and to keep her daughter close. There were Nazi soldiers everywhere, riding in lorries and on motorcycles with machine gun-mounted sidecars. They marched in the square, their voices raised in triumphant song. A military lorry honked at them, and they moved farther onto the sidewalk as a convoy rumbled past. More Nazis. "Is that Tante Isabel?" Sophie asked. Vianne glanced in the direction of Sophie's finger. Sure enough, Isabel was coming out of an alley, clutching her basket. She looked furtive was the only word that came to mind. Furtive. At that, a dozen little pieces clicked into place. Tiny incongruities became a pattern. Isabel had often left Le Jardin in the wee hours of the morning, much earlier than necessary. She had dozens of long-winded excuses for absences that Vianne had barely cared about. Heels that broke, hats that flew off in the wind and had to be chased down, a dog that frightened her and blocked her way. Was she sneaking out to be with a boy? "Tante Isabel!" Sophie cried out. Without waiting for a reply or permission, Sophie darted into the street. She dodged a trio of German soldiers who were tossing a ball back and forth. "Merde," Vianne muttered. "Pardon," she said, ducking around the soldiers and striding across the cobblestone street. "What did you get today?" she heard Sophie ask Isabel as her daughter reached into the willow basket. Isabel slapped Sophie's hand, hard. Sophie yelped and drew her hand back. "Isabel," Vianne said harshly, "what's wrong with you?" Isabel had the good grace to blush. "I'm sorry, it's just that I'm tired. I have been in queues all day, and for what? A veal jelly bone with barely any meat on it, and a tin of milk. It's disheartening. Still, I shouldn't be rude. I'm sorry, Soph." "Perhaps if you didn't sneak out so early in the morning, you wouldn't be tired," Vianne said. "I'm not sneaking out," Isabel said. "I'm going to the shops for food. I thought you wanted that of me. And by the way, we need a bicycle. These walks to town on bad shoes are killing me." Vianne wished she knew her sister well enough to read the look in her eyes. Was it guilt or worry or defiance? If she didn't know better, she'd say it was pride. Sophie linked arms with Isabel as the three of them set off for home. Vianne studiously ignored the changes to Caravo. The Nazis taking up so much space, the posters on the limestone walls, the new anti-Jewish tracts were sickening, and the red and black swastika flags hanging above doorways and from balconies. People had begun to leave Caravo, abandoning their homes to the Germans. The rumor was that they were going to the free zone, but no one knew for sure. Shops closed and didn't reopen. She heard footsteps coming up behind her and said evenly, "Let's walk faster." "Madame Mauriac, if I may interrupt." "Good Lord, is he following you?" Isabel muttered. Vianne slowly turned around. "Herr Captain," she said. People in the street watched Vianne closely, eyes narrowed in disapproval. "I wanted to say that I will be late tonight and will, sorrowfully, not be there for supper," Beck said. "How terrible," Isabel said in a voice as sweet and bitter as burned caramel. Vianne tried to smile, but really, she didn't know why he'd stopped her. "I will save you something." Nine, you are most kind." He fell silent. Vianne did the same. Finally, Isabel sighed heavily. "We are on our way home, Herr Captain." "Is there something I can do for you, Herr Captain?" said Vianne. Beck moved closer. "I know how worried you have been about your husband, so I did some checking." "Oh, it is not fine news, I am sorrowful to report. Your husband, Antoine Mauriac, has been captured along with many of your townsmen. He is in a prisoner of war camp." He handed her a list of names and a stack of official postcards. "He will not be coming home." Vianne barely remembered leaving town. She knew Isabel was beside her, holding her upright, urging her to put one foot in front of the other, and that Sophie was beside her, chirping out questions as sharp as fish hooks. "What is a prisoner of war? What did Herr Captain mean that Papa would not be coming home? Never?" Vianne knew when they'd arrived home because the sense of her garden greeted her, welcomed her. She blinked, feeling a little like someone who had just wakened from a coma to find the world impossibly changed. "Sophie," Isabel said firmly, "go make your mother a cup of coffee. Open a tin of milk." "But..." "Go," Isabel said. When Sophie was gone, Isabel turned to Vianne, cupped her face with cold hands. "He'll be all right." Vianne felt as if she were breaking apart by bit, losing blood and bone as she stood there, contemplating something she had studiously avoided thinking about, a life without him. She started to shiver. Her teeth chattered. "Come inside for coffee," Isabel said. "Into the house? Their house? His ghost would be everywhere in there. A dent in the divan where he sat to read, the hook that held his coat, and the bed." She shook her head, wishing she could cry, but there were no tears in her. This news had emptied her. She couldn't even breathe. Suddenly, all she could think about was the sweater of his that she was wearing. She started to strip out of her clothes, tearing off the coat and the vest, ignoring Isabel shouting, "No!" as she yanked the sweater over her head and buried her face in the soft wool, trying to smell him in the yarn. His favorite soap. Him. But there was nothing but her own smell. She lowered the bunched-up sweater from her face and stared down at it, trying to remember the last time he'd worn it. She picked at a loose thread, and it unraveled in her hand, became a squiggly coil of wine-colored yarn. She bit it off and tied a knot to save the rest of the sleeve. Yarn was precious these days. These days. When the world was at war and everything was scarce and your husband was gone. "I don't know how to be on my own." "What do you mean? We were on our own for years, from the moment Maman died." Vianne blinked. Her sister's words sounded a little jumbled, as if they were running on the wrong speed. "You were alone," she said. "I never was. I met Antoine when I was 14 and got pregnant at 16 and married him when I was barely 17. Papa gave me this house to get rid of me. So you see, I've never been on my own. That's why you're so strong and I'm not." "You will have to be," Isabel said, "for Sophie." Vianne drew in a breath and there it was. The reason she couldn't eat a bowl of arsenic or throw herself in front of a train. She took the short coil of crooked yarn and tied it to an apple tree branch. The burgundy color stood out against the green and brown. Now, each day in her garden, and when she walked to her gate, and when she picked apples, she would pass this branch and see this bit of yarn and think of Antoine. Each time she would pray to him and to God, "Come home." "Come," Isabel said, putting an arm around Vianne, pulling her close inside. The house echoed the voice of a man who wasn't there. Vianne stood outside Rachel's stone cottage. Overhead, the sky was the color of smoke on this cold, late afternoon. The leaves of the trees, marigold and tangerine and scarlet, were just beginning to darken around the edges. Soon they would drop to the ground. Vianne stared at the door, wishing she didn't need to be here. But she had read the names Beck had given her. Marc de Champlain was also listed. When she finally found the courage to knock, Rachel answered almost instantly, wearing an old house dress and sagging woolen stockings. A cardigan sweater hung askew, buttoned incorrectly. It gave her an odd, tilted look. "Vianne, come in. Sarah and I were just making a rice pudding. It's mostly water and gelatin, of course, but I used a bit of milk." Vianne managed a smile. She let her friend sweep her into the kitchen and pour her a cup of the bitter ersatz coffee that was all they could get. Vianne was remarking on the rice pudding. What she even said she didn't know. When Rachel turned and asked, "What's wrong?" Vianne stared at her friend. She wanted to be the strong one, for once, but she couldn't stop the tears that filled her eyes. "Stay in the kitchen," Rachel said to Sarah. "If you hear your brother wake up, get him." "You," she said to Vianne, "come with me." She took Vianne by the arm and guided her through the small salon and into Rachel's bedroom. Vianne sat on the bed and looked up at her friend. Silently, she held out the list of names she'd gotten from Beck. "They are prisoners of war, Rachel. Antoine and Marc and all the others. They won't be coming home." 3 days later, on a frosty Saturday morning, Vianne stood in her classroom and stared out at the group of women seated in desks that were too small for them. They looked tired and a little wary. No one felt comfortable gathering these days. It was never clear exactly how far verboten extended into conversations about the war. And besides that, the women of Caraville were exhausted. They spent their days standing in line for insufficient quantities of food, and when they weren't in line, they were foraging the countryside or trying to sell their dancing shoes or a silk scarf for enough money to buy a loaf of good bread. In the back of the room, tucked into the corner, Sophie and Sarah were leaning against each other, knees drawn up, reading books. Rachel moved her sleeping son from one shoulder to the other and closed the door of the classroom. "Thank you all for coming. I know how difficult it is these days to do anything more than the absolute necessary." There was a murmuring of agreement among the women. "Why are we here?" Madame Fournier asked tiredly. Vianne stepped forward. She had never felt completely comfortable around some of the women, many of whom had disliked Vianne when she moved here at 14. When Vianne had caught Antoine, the best-looking young man in town, they'd liked her even less. Those days were long past, of course, and now Vianne was friendly with these women and taught their children and frequented their shops. But even so, the pains of adolescence left a residue of discomfort. "I have received a list of French prisoners of war from Caraville. I am sorry, terribly sorry, to tell you that your husband's and mine and Rachel's are on the list. I am told they will not be coming home." She paused, allowing the women to react. Grief and loss transformed the faces around her. Vianne knew the pain mirrored her own. Even so, it was difficult to watch, and she found her eyes misting again. Rachel stepped close, took her hand. "I got us postcards," Vianne said, "official ones, so we can write to our men." "How did you get so many postcards?" Madame Fournier asked, wiping her eyes. "She asked her German for a favor," said Helene Ruel, the baker's wife. "I did not. And he's not my German," Vianne said. "He is a soldier who has requisitioned my home. Should I just let the Germans have Le Jardin? Just walk away and have nothing? Every house or hotel in town with a spare room has been taken by them. I am not special in this." More tisking and murmurs. Some women nodded, others shook their heads. I would have killed myself before I let one of them move into my house, Helene said. Would you, Helene? Would you really? The aunt said. And would you kill your children first or throw them out into the street to survive on their own? Helene looked away. They have taken over my hotel, a woman said, and they are gentlemen, for the most part, a bit crude, perhaps, wasteful. Gentlemen, Helene spat the word, we are pigs to slaughter, you will see, pigs who put up no fight at all. I haven't seen you at my butcher shop recently, Madame Fournier said to Vianne in a judgmental voice. My sister goes for me, Vianne said. She knew this was the point of their disapproval. They were afraid that Vianne would get and take special privileges that they would be denied. I would not take food or anything from the enemy. She felt suddenly as if he were back in school, being bullied by the popular girls. Vianne is trying to help, Rachel said sternly enough to shut them up. She took the postcards from Vianne and began handing them out. Vianne took a seat and stared down at her own blank postcard. She heard the chicken scratching of other pencils on other postcards, and slowly she began to write. My beloved Antoine, we are well. Sophie is thriving, and even with so many chores, we found some time this summer to spend by the river. I think of you with every breath and pray you are well. Do not worry about us, and come home. Je t'aime, Antoine. Her lettering was so small she wondered if he would even be able to read it, or if he would get it, or if he was alive. For God's sake, she was crying. Rachel moved in beside her, laid a hand on her shoulder. We all feel it, she said quietly. Moments later, the women rose, one by one. Wordlessly, they shuffled forward and gave Vianne their postcards. Don't let them hurt your feelings, Rachel said. They're just scared. I'm scared, too, Vianne said. Rachel pressed her postcard to her chest, her fingers splayed across a small square of paper, as if she needed to touch each corner. How can we not be? Afterward, when they returned to Le Jardin, Beck's motorcycle with the machine gun mounted sidecar was parked in the grass outside the gate. Rachel turned to her. Do you want us to come in with you? Vianne appreciated the worry in Rachel's gaze, and she knew that if she asked for help, she would get it. But how was she to be helped? No, merci. We are fine. He has probably forgotten something and will soon leave again. He is rarely here these days. Where is Isabel? A good question. She sneaks out every Friday morning before the sunrise. She leaned closer, whispered, I think she's meeting a boy. Good for her. To that, Vianne had no answer. Will he mail the postcards for us? Rachel asks. I hope so. Vianne stared at her friend a moment longer. Then she said, Well, we will know soon enough, and led Sophie into the house. Once inside, she instructed Sophie to go upstairs to read. Her daughter was used to such directives, and she didn't mind. Vianne tried to keep her daughter and Beck separated as much as possible. He was seated at the dining room table with papers spread out in front of him. At her entrance, he looked up. A drop of ink fell from the tip of his fountain pen, landed in a blue starburst on the white sheet of paper in front of him. Madame, most excellent. I am pleased you are returned. She moved forward cautiously, holding the packet of postcards tightly. They had been tied up with a scrap of twine. I have some postcards here, written by friends in town, to our husbands, but we don't know where to send them. I hope perhaps you could help us. She shifted uncomfortably from one foot to the other, feeling acutely vulnerable. Of course, madame, I would be pleased to do this favor for you, although it will take much time and research to accomplish. He rose politely. As it happens, I am now concocting a list for my superiors at the Commandantur. They need to know the names of some of the teachers at your school. Oh, she said, uncertain as to why he would tell her this. He never spoke of his work. Of course, they didn't speak often about anything. Jews, communists, homosexuals, Freemasons, Jehovah's Witnesses. Do you know these people? I am Catholic, Herr Captain. As you know, we do not speak of such things at school. I hardly know who are homosexuals and Freemasons, at any rate. Ah, so you know the others. I don't understand. I am unclear. My pardons. I would appreciate it most sternly if you would let me know the names of the teachers in your school who are Jewish or communists. Why do you need their names? It is clerical, merely. You know us Germans. We are list makers. He smiled and pulled out a chair for her. Vianne stared down at the blank paper on the table, then at the postcards in her hand. If Antoine received one, he might write back. She might know at last if he was alive. This is not secret information, Herr Captain. Anyone can give you these names. He moved in close to her. With some effort, madame, I believe I can find your husband's address and mail a package for you also. Would this be sanguine? Sanguine is not the right word, Herr Capitan. You mean to ask me if it would be all right. She was stalling, and she knew it. Worse, she was pretty sure that he knew it. Ah, thank you so much for tutoring me in your beautiful language. My apologies. He offered her a pen. Do not worry, madame. It is clerical, merely. Vianne wanted to say that she wouldn't write down any names, but what would be the point? It was easy enough for him to get this information in town. Everyone knew whose names belonged on the list, and Beck would throw her out of her own house for such a defiance. And what would she do then? She sat down and picked up the pen and began to write down names. It wasn't until the end of the list that she paused and lifted the pen tip from the paper. I'm done, she said in a soft voice. You haven't forgotten your friend. Did I? Surely you meant to be accurate. She bit her lip nervously and looked down at the list of names. She was certain, suddenly, that she shouldn't have done this. But what choice did she have? He was in control of her home. What would happen if she defied him? Slowly, feeling sick to her stomach, she wrote the last name on the list. Rachel de Champlain. Chapter 12. On a particularly cold morning in late November, Vianne woke with tears on her cheeks. She had been dreaming about Antoine again. With a sigh, she eased out of bed, taking care not to waken Sophie. Vianne had slept fully dressed, wearing a woolen vest, a long-sleeved sweater, woolen stockings, a pair of flannel pants, Antoine's cut down to fit her, and a knit cap and mittens. It wasn't even Christmas, and already layering had become de rigueur. She added a cardigan, and still she was cold. She burrowed her mittened hands into the slit at the foot of the mattress and withdrew the leather pouch Antoine had left for her. Not much money remained in it. Soon they would have to live on her teaching salary alone. She returned the money. Counting it had become an obsession since the weather turned cold, and went downstairs. There was never enough of anything anymore. The pipes froze at night, and so there was no water until midday. Vianne had taken to leaving buckets full of water positioned near the stove and fireplaces for washing. Gas and electricity were scarce, as was money to pay for them, so she was miserly with both. The flames on her stove were so low it barely boiled water. They rarely turned on the lights. She made a fire and then wrapped herself in a heavy eiderdown and sat on the divan. Beside her was a bag of yarn that she'd collected by pulling apart one of her old sweaters. She was making Sophie's scarf for Christmas, and these early morning hours were the only time she could find. With only the creaking of the house for company, she focused on the pale blue yarn and the way the knitting needles dove in and out of the soft strands, creating every moment something that hadn't existed before. It calmed her nerves, this once ordinary morning ritual. If she loosed her thoughts, she might remember her mother sitting beside her, teaching her, saying, "Knit one, purl two, that's right, beautiful." Or Antoine, coming down the stairs in his stockinged feet, smiling, asking her what she was making for him. Antoine. The front door opened slowly, bringing a burst of ice-cold air and a flurry of leaves. Isabel came in, wearing Antoine's old wool coat and knee-high boots and a scarf that coiled around her head and neck, obscuring all but her eyes. She saw Vianne and came to a sudden stop. "Oh, you're up." She unwound the scarf and hung up her coat. There was no mistaking the guilty look on her face. "I was out checking on the chickens." Vianne's hands still, the needles paused. "You might as well tell me who he is, this boy you keep sneaking out to meet." "Who would meet a boy in this cold?" Isabel went to Vianne, pulling her to her feet, leading her to the fire. At the sudden warmth, Vianne shivered. She hadn't realized how cold she'd been. "You," she said, surprised that it made her smile, "you would sneak out in the cold to meet a boy. He would have to be some boy, Clark Gable, maybe." Sophie rushed into the room, snuggling up to Vianne. "This feels good," she said, holding out her hands. For a beautiful, tender moment, Vianne forgot her worries, and then Isabel said, Well, I'd best go. I need to be first in the butcher's queue. You need to eat something before you go, Vian said. Give mine to Sophie, Isabel answered, pulling the coat back on and rewinding the scarf around her head. Vian walked her sister to the door, watched her slip out into the darkness, then returned to the kitchen and lit an oil lamp and went down to the cellar pantry, where rows of shelving ran along the stone wall. 2 years ago, this pantry had been full to overflowing with ham smoked in ash and jars full of duck fat set beside coils of sausage, bottles of aged champagne vinegar, tins of sardines, jars of jam. Now they were nearly to the end of the chicory coffee. The last of the sugar was a sparkly white residue in the glass container, and the flour was more precious than gold. Thank God the garden had produced a good crop of vegetables in spite of the war refugees' rampage. She had canned and preserved every single fruit and vegetable, no matter how undersized. She reached for a piece of wholemeal bread that was about to go bad. As breakfast for growing girls went, a boiled egg and a piece of toast wasn't much, but it could be worse. I want more, Sophie said when she'd finished. I can't, Vian said. The Germans are taking all of our food, Sophie said, just as Beck emerged from his room, dressed in his gray-green uniform. Sophie, Vian said sharply. Well, it is true, young lady, that we German soldiers are taking much of the food France produces, but men who are fighting need to eat. Do they not? Sophie frowned up at him. Doesn't everyone need to eat? Oui, mademoiselle. And we Germans do not only take, we give back to our friends. He reached into the pocket of his uniform and drew out a chocolate bar. Chocolate! Sophie, no, Vian said, but Beck was charming her daughter, teasing her as he made the chocolate bar disappear and reappear by sleight of hand. At last he gave it to Sophie, who squealed and ripped off the paper. Beck approached Vian. You look sad this morning, he said quietly. Vian didn't know how to respond. He smiled and left. Outside, she heard his motorcycle start up and putter away. That was good chocolate, Sophie said, smacking her lips. You know, it would have been a good idea to have a small piece each night rather than to gobble it all up at once. And I shouldn't have to mention the virtues of sharing. Tante Isabel says it's better to be bold than meek. She says if you jump off a cliff, at least you'll fly before you fall. Ah, yes, that sounds like Isabel. Perhaps you should ask her about the time she broke her wrist jumping from a tree she shouldn't have been climbing in the first place. Come on, let's go to school. Outside, they waited at the side of the muddy, icy road for Rachel and the children. Together, they set off on the long, cold walk to school. I ran out of coffee 4 days ago, Rachel said, in case you've been wondering why I have been such a witch. I'm the one who has been short-tempered lately, Vian said. She waited for Rachel to disagree, but Rachel knew her well enough to know when a simple statement wasn't so simple. It's that I've had some things on my mind. The list. She'd written down the names weeks ago, and nothing had come of it. Still, worry lingered. Antoine? Starvation? Freezing to death? Rachel smiled. What small worry has obsessed you this week? The school bell pealed. Hurry, maman, we are late, Sophie said, grabbing her by the arm, dragging her forward. Vian let herself be led up the stone steps. She and Sophie and Sarah turned into Vian's classroom, which was already filled with students. You are late, Madame Mauriac, Gilles said with a smile. That's one demerit for you. Everyone laughed. Vian took off her coat and hung it up. You are very humorous, Gilles, as usual. Let's see if you're still smiling after our spelling test. This time they groaned, and Vian couldn't help smiling at their crestfallen faces. They all looked so disheartened. It was difficult, honestly, to feel otherwise in this cold, blacked-out room that didn't have enough light to dispel the shadows. Oh, what the heck! It is a cold morning. Maybe a game of tag is what we need to get our blood running. A roar of approval filled the room. Vian barely had time to grab her coat before she was swept out of the classroom on a tide of laughing children. They had been outside only a few moments when Vian heard the grumble of automobiles coming toward the school. The children didn't notice. They only noticed aeroplanes these days, it seemed, and went on with their play. Vian walked down to the end of the building and peered around the corner. A black Mercedes-Benz roared up the dirt driveway, its fenders decorated with small swastika flags that flapped in the cold. Behind it was a French police car. "Children," Van said, rushing back to the courtyard. "Come here. Stand by me." Two men rounded the corner and came into view. One she had never seen before. He was a tall, elegant, almost effete blonde man, wearing a long black leather coat and spit-shined shoes. An iron cross decorated his stand-up collar. The other man she knew. He had been a policeman in Caraveau for years. Paul Jolert. Antoine had often remarked that he had a mean and cowardly streak. "Madame Mauriac," the French police officer said with an officious nod. She didn't like the look in his eyes. It reminded her of how boys sometimes looked at one another when they were about to bully a weaker child. "Bonjour, Paul. We are here for some of your colleagues. There is nothing to concern you, madame. You are not on our list." List. "What do you want with my colleagues?" she heard herself asking, but her voice was almost inaudible, even though the children were silent. "Some teachers will be dismissed today." "Dismissed? Why?" The Nazi agent flicked his pale hand as if he were batting at a fly. "Jews and communists and Freemasons. Others," he sneered, "who are no longer permitted to teach school or work in civil service or in the judiciary." "But..." The Nazi nodded at the French policeman, and the two turned as one and marched into the school. "Madame Mauriac," someone said, tugging on her sleeve. "Maman," Sophie said, whining. "They can't do that, can they?" "Of course they can," Gil said. "Damn Nazi bastards." Vianne should have disciplined him for his language, but she couldn't think of anything except the list of names she'd given to Beck. Vianne wrestled with her conscience for hours. She continued teaching for much of the day, although she couldn't remember how. All that stuck in her mind was the look Rachel had given her as she walked out of the school with the other dismissed teachers. Finally, at noon, although they were already shorthanded at school, Vianne had asked another teacher to take over her classroom. Now she stood at the edge of the town square. All the way here she had planned what she would say, but when she saw the Nazi flag flying above the Hotel de Ville, her resolve faltered. Everywhere she looked, there were German soldiers walking in pairs or riding gorgeous, well-fed horses or darting up the streets in shiny black Citroëns. Across the square, a Nazi blew his whistle and used his rifle to force an old man to his knees. "Go, Vianne." She walked up the stone steps to the closed oak doors, where a fresh-faced young guard stopped her and demanded to know her business. "I am here to see Captain Beck," she said. "Ah." The guard opened the door for her and pointed up the wide stone staircase, making the number 2 with his fingers. Vianne stepped into the main room of the town hall. It was crowded with men in uniforms. She tried not to make eye contact with anyone as she hurried across the lobby to the stairs, which she ascended under the watchful eyes of the Führer, whose portrait took up much of the wall. On the second floor, she found a man in uniform, and she said to him, "Captain Beck, s'il vous plaît." "Oui, madame." He showed her to a door at the end of the hall and rapped smartly upon it. At a response from within, he opened the door for her. Beck was seated behind an ornate black and gold desk, obviously taken from one of the grand homes in the area. Behind him, a portrait of Hitler and a collection of maps were affixed to the walls. On his desk was a typewriter and a Ronio machine. In the corner stood a pile of confiscated radios, but worst of all was the food. There were boxes and boxes of food, heaps of cured meats and wheels of cheese stacked against the back wall. "Madame Mauriac," he said, rising quickly, "what a most pleasant surprise." He came toward her. "What may I do for you?" "It's about the teachers you fired at the school." "Not I, madame." Vianne glanced at the open door behind them and took a step toward him, lowering her voice to say, "You told me the list of names was clerical in nature." "I am sorry, truly. This is what I was told. We need them at the school. You being here, it is... dangerous, perhaps." He closed the small distance between them. "You do not want to draw attention to yourself, Madame Mauriac. Not here. There is a man..." He glanced at the door and stopped speaking. "Go, madame." "I wish you hadn't asked me." "As do I, madame." He gave her an understanding look. "Now go. Please, you should not be here." Vian turned away from Captain Beck and all that food and the picture of the Fuhrer and left his office. On her way down the stairs, she saw how the soldiers observed her, smiling to one another, no doubt joking about another French woman courting a dashing German soldier who had just broken her heart. But it wasn't until she stepped back out into the sunshine that she realized fully her mistake. Several women were in the square, or near it, and they saw her step out of the Nazis' lair. One of the women was Isabel. Vianne hurried down the steps toward Hélène Ruel, the baker's wife, who was delivering bread to the commandanteur. "Socializing, Madame Mauriac?" Hélène said archly as Vianne rushed past her. Isabel was practically running across the square toward her. With a defeated sigh, Vianne came to a standstill, waiting for her sister to reach her. "What were you doing in there?" Isabel demanded, her voice too loud, or maybe that was only to Vianne's ears. "They fired the teachers today." "No, not all of them, just the Jews and the Freemasons and the Communists." The memory welled up in her, made her feel sick. She remembered the quiet hallway and the confusion among the teachers who remained. No one knew what to do, how to defy the Nazis. "Just them, huh?" Isabel said, her face tightening. "I didn't mean it to sound that way. I meant to clarify. They didn't fire all the teachers." Even to her own ears it sounded a feeble excuse, so she shut up. "And this says nothing to explain your presence at their headquarters? I thought Captain Beck could help us, help Rachel." "You went to Beck for a favor?" "I had to." "French women do not ask Nazis for help, Vianne. Mon Dieu, you must know this." "I know," Vianne said defiantly, but what?" Vianne couldn't hold it in anymore. "I gave him a list of names." Isabel went very still. For an instant, she seemed not to be breathing. The look she gave Vianne stung more than a slap across the face. "How could you do that? Did you give him Rachel's name?"
I didn't know," Vianne stammered. "How could I know? He said it was clerical."
She grabbed Isabel's hand.
"Forgive me, Isabel. Truly, I didn't know."
"It is not my forgiveness you need to seek, Vianne." Vianne felt a stinging, profound shame. How could she have been so foolish, and how in God's name could she make amends? She glanced at her wristwatch. Classes would be ending soon. "Go to the school," Vianne said. "Get Sophie, Sarah, and take them home. There's something I need to do."
"Whatever it is, I hope you've thought it through."
"Go," Vianne said tiredly. The Chapel of Saint-Jean was a small stone Norman church at the edge of town. Behind it, and within its medieval walls, lay the convent of the Sisters of St. Joseph, nuns who ran both an orphanage and a school. Vianne went into the church, her footsteps echoing on the cold stone floor. Her breath plumed in front of her. She took off her mittens just long enough to touch her fingertips to the frozen holy water. She made the sign of the cross and went to an empty pew. She genuflected and then knelt. Closing her eyes, she bent her head in prayer. She needed guidance and forgiveness, but for the first time in her life she could find no words for her prayer. How could she be forgiven for such a foolish, thoughtless act? God would see her guilt and fear, and he would judge her. She lowered her clasped hands and climbed back up to sit on the wooden pew. "Vianne Mauriac, is that you?" Mother Superior Marie Therese moved in beside Vianne and sat down. She waited for Vianne to speak. It had always been this way between them. The first time Vianne had come to Mother for advice, Vianne had been 16 years old and pregnant. It had been Mother who comforted Vianne after Papa called her a disgrace, Mother who had planned for a rushed wedding and talked Papa into letting Vianne and Antoine have Le Jardin, Mother who promised Vianne that a child was always a miracle and that young love could endure. "You know there is a German billeted at my house," Vianne said finally. "They are at all of the big homes and in every hotel. He asked me which of the teachers at school were Jewish or communists or Freemasons."
"Ah, and you answered him?"
"That makes me the fool Isabel calls me, doesn't it?"
"You are no fool, Vianne." She gazed at Vianne.
"And your sister is quick to judge. That much I remember about her. I ask myself if they would have found these names without my help. They have dismissed Jews from positions all over town. Do you not know this? Monsieur Pemois is not the postmaster anymore, and Judge Breus has been replaced. I have had news from Paris that the headmistress of Collège Saint-Vin
was forced to resign, as have all of the Jewish singers at the Paris Opera. Perhaps they needed your help. Perhaps they did not. Certainly, they would have found the names without your help, Mother said in a voice that was both gentle and stern. But that is not what matters. What do you mean? I think, as this war goes on, we will all have to look more deeply. These questions are not about them, but about us. Vianne felt tears sting her eyes. I don't know what to do anymore. Antoine always took care of everything. The Wehrmacht and the Gestapo are more than I can handle. Don't think about who they are. Think about who you are and what sacrifices you can live with and what will break you. It's all breaking me. I need to be more like Isabel. She is so certain of everything. This war is black and white for her. Nothing seems to scare her. Isabel will have her crisis of faith in this too, as will we all. I have been here before, in the Great War. I know the hardships are just beginning. You must stay strong. By believing in God? Yes, of course, but not only by believing in God. Prayers and faith will not be enough, I'm afraid. The path of righteousness is often dangerous. Get ready, Vianne. This is only your first test. Learn from it. Mother leaned forward and hugged Vianne again. Vianne held on tightly, her face pressed to the scratchy wool habit. When she pulled back, she felt a little better. Mother Superior stood, took Vianne's hand, and drew her to a stand. Perhaps you could find the time to visit the children this week and give them a lesson. They loved it when you taught them painting. As you can imagine, there's a lot of grumbling about empty bellies these days. Praise the Lord, the sisters have an excellent garden, and the goat's milk and cheese is God's end. Still, yes, Vianne said, everyone knew about how the belt tightening felt, especially to children. You're not alone, and you're not the one in charge, Mother said gently. Ask for help when you need it, and give help when you can. I think that is how we serve God, and each other and ourselves, in times as dark as these. You're not the one in charge. Vianne contemplated Mother's words all the way home. She had always taken great comfort in her faith. When Maman had first begun to cough, and then when that coughing deepened into a hacking shudder that left sprays of blood on handkerchiefs, Vianne had prayed to God for all that she needed, help, guidance, a way to cheat the death that had come to call. At 14, she promised God anything, everything, if he would just spare her Maman's life. With her prayers unanswered, she returned to God and prayed for the strength to deal with the aftermath, her loneliness, Papa's bleak, angry silences and drunken rages, Isabel's wailing neediness. Time and again she had returned to God, pleading for help, promising her faith. She wanted to believe that she was neither alone nor in charge, but rather that her life was unfolding according to his plan, even if she couldn't see it. Now, though, such hope felt as slight and bendable as tin. She was alone, and there was no one else in charge, no one but the Nazis. She had made a terrible, grievous mistake. She couldn't take it back, however much she might hope for such a chance. She couldn't undo it, but a good woman would accept responsibility and blame and apologize. Whatever else she was or wasn't, whatever her feelings, she intended to be a good woman. And so she knew what she needed to do. She knew it, and still, when she came to the gate at Rachel's cottage, she found herself unable to move. Her feet felt heavy, her heart even more so. She took a deep breath and knocked on the door. There was a shuffling of feet within, and then the door opened. Rachel held her sleeping son in one arm and had a pair of dungarees slung over the other. "Vianne," she said, smiling, "come in." Vianne almost gave in to cowardice. "Oh, Rachel, I just stopped by to say hello." Instead, she took a deep breath and followed her friend into the house. She took her usual place in the comfortable upholstered chair tucked in close to the blazing fire. "Take Ari. I'll make us coffee." Vianne reached for the sleeping baby and took him in her arms. He snuggled close, and she stroked his back and kissed the back of his head. "We heard that some care packages were being delivered to prisoner of war camps by the Red Cross," Rachel said a moment later, coming into the room, carrying two cups of coffee. She set one down on the table next to Vianne. "Where are the girls?" "At my house with Isabel, probably learning how to shoot a gun." Rachel laughed. "There are worse skills to have." She pulled the dungarees from her shoulder and tossed them onto a straw basket with the rest of her sewing. Then she sat down across from Vianne. Vianne breathed in deeply of the sweet scent that was pure baby. When she looked up, Rachel was staring at her. "Is it one of those days?" she asked quietly. Vianne gave an unsteady smile. Rachel knew how much Vianne sometimes mourned her lost babies and how deeply she prayed for more children. It had been difficult between them. Not a lot, but a little, when Rachel had gotten pregnant with Ari. There was joy for Rachel and a thread of envy. "No," she said. She lifted her chin slowly, looked her best friend in the eyes. "I have something to tell you." "What?" Vianne drew in a breath. "Do you remember the day we wrote the postcards, and Captain Beck was waiting for me when we got home?" "Oui, I offered to come in with you." "I wish you had, although I don't suppose it would have made a difference. He just would have waited until you left." Rachel started to rise. "Did he?" "No, no," she said quickly. "Not that. He was working at the dining room table that day, writing something when I returned. He asked me for a list of names. He wanted to know which of the teachers at the school were Jewish or communist." She paused. "He asked about homosexuals and Freemasons, too, as if people talk about such things." "You told him you didn't know." Shame made Vianne look away, but only for a second. She forced herself to say, "I gave him your name, Rachel, along with the others." Rachel went very still. The color drained from her face, making her dark eyes stand out. "And they fired us." Vianne swallowed hard, nodded. Rachel got to her feet and walked past Vianne without stopping, ignoring her pleading, "Please, Rachel," pulling away so she couldn't be touched. She went into her bedroom and slammed the door shut. Time passed slowly in indrawn breaths and captured prayers and creaks of the chair. Vianne watched the tiny black hands on the mantel clock click forward. She patted the baby's back in rhythm with the passing minutes. Finally, the door opened. Rachel walked back into the room. Her hair was a mess, as if she'd been shoving her hands through it. Her cheeks were blotchy from either anxiety or anger, maybe both. Her eyes were red from crying. "I'm so sorry," Vianne said, rising. "Forgive me." Rachel came to a stop in front of her, looking down at her. Anger flashed in her eyes, then faded, and was replaced by resignation. "Everyone in town knows I'm a Jew, Vianne. I've always been proud of it." "I know that. It's what I told myself. Still, I shouldn't have helped him. I am sorry. I wouldn't hurt you for the world. I hope you know that." "Of course I know that," Rachel said quietly. "But, V, you need to be more careful. I know Beck is young and handsome and friendly and polite, but he's a Nazi, and they are dangerous." The winter of 1940 was the coldest anyone could remember. Snow fell day after day, blanketing the trees and fields. Icicles glittered on drooping tree branches. And still, Isabel woke every Friday morning, hours before dawn, and distributed her terrorist papers, as the Nazis now called them. Last week's tract followed the military operations in North Africa and alerted the French people to the fact that the winter's food shortages were not a result of the British blockades, as Nazi propaganda insisted, but rather were caused by the Germans looting everything France produced. Isabel had been distributing these tracts for months now, and truthfully, she couldn't see that they were having much impact on the people of Caraveau. Many of the villagers still supported Pétain, even more didn't care. A disturbing number of her neighbors looked upon the Germans and thought, so young, just boys, and went on trudging through life with their heads down, just trying to stay out of danger. The Nazis had noticed the flyers, of course. Some French men and women would use any excuse to curry favor, and giving the Nazis the flyers they found in their letterboxes was a start. Isabel knew that the Germans were looking for whoever printed and distributed the tracts, but they weren't looking too hard, especially not on these snowy days when the Blitz of London was all anyone could talk about. Perhaps the Germans knew that words on a piece of paper were not enough to turn the tide of a war. Today, Isabel lay in bed, with Sophie curled like a tiny sword fern beside her, and Vianne sleeping heavily on the girl's other side. The three of them now slept together in Vianne's bed. Over the past month, they'd added every quilt and blanket they could find to the bed. Isabel lay watching her breath gather and disappear in thin white clouds. She knew how cold the floor would be, even through the woolen stockings she wore to bed. She knew this was the last time all day she would be warm. She steeled herself and eased out from underneath a pile of quilts. Beside her, Sophie made a moaning sound and rolled over to her mother's body for heat. When Isabel's feet hit the floor, pain shot into her shins. She winced and hobbled out of the room. The stairs took forever. Her feet hurt so badly. The damp, chill blains, everyone was suffering from them this winter. Supposedly, it was from a lack of butter and fat, but Isabel knew it was caused by cold weather and socks full of holes and shoes that were coming apart at the seams. She wanted to start a fire, ached for even a moment's warmth, really, but they were on their last bit of wood. In late January, they started ripping out barn wood and burning it, along with toolboxes and old chairs and whatever else they could find. She made herself a cup of boiling water and drank it down, letting the heat and weight trick her stomach into thinking it wasn't empty. She ate a small bit of stale bread, wrapped her body in a layer of newsprint, and then put on Antoine's coat and her own mittens and boots. A woolen scarf she wrapped around her head and neck, and even so, when she stepped outside, the cold took her breath away. She closed the door behind her and trudged out into the snow, her chilblained toes throbbing with every step, her fingers going cold instantly, even inside the mittens. It was eerily quiet out there. She hiked through the knee-deep snow and opened the broken gate and stepped out onto the white-packed road. Because of the cold and snow, it took her 3 hours to deliver her papers. This week's content was about the Blitz. The Boches had dropped 32,000 bombs on London in one night alone. Dawn, when it came, was as weak as meatless broth. She was the first in line at the butcher's shop, but others soon followed. At 7 a.m., the butcher's wife rolled open the window gate and unlocked the door. "Octopus," the woman said. Isabel felt a pang of disappointment. "No meat? Not for the French, mademoiselle." She heard grumbling behind her from the women who wanted meat, and farther back from the women who knew they wouldn't even be lucky enough to get octopus. Isabel took the paper-wrapped octopus and left the shop. At least she'd gotten something. There was no tinned milk to be had anymore, not with ration cards or even on the black market. She was fortunate enough to get a little Camembert after 2 more hours in line. She covered her precious items with the heavy towel in her basket and hobbled down Rue Victor Hugo. As she passed a café filled with German soldiers and French policemen, she smelled brewed coffee and freshly baked croissants, and her stomach grumbled. "Mademoiselle." A French policeman nodded crisply and indicated a need to step around her. She moved aside and watched him put up a poster in an abandoned storefront's window. The first poster read, "Notice, shot for spying. The Jew, Jacob Mansard, the communist Victor Yablonsky, and the Jew, Louis Devry." And the second, "Notice, henceforth, all French people arrested for any crime or infraction will be considered hostages. When a hostile act against Germany occurs in France, hostages will be shot." "They're shooting ordinary French people for nothing?" she said. "Don't look so pale, mademoiselle. These warnings are not for beautiful women such as yourself." Isabel glared at the man. He was worse than the Germans. A Frenchman doing this to his own people. This was why she hated the Vichy government. What good was self-rule for half of France if it turned them into Nazi puppets? "Are you unwell, mademoiselle?" So solicitous, so caring. What would he do if she called him a traitor and spat in his face? "I am fine, merci." She watched him cross the street confidently, his back straight, his hat positioned just so on his cropped brown hair. The German soldiers in the café welcomed him warmly, clapped him on the back, and pulled him into their midst. Isabel turned away in disgust. That was when she saw it, a bright silver bicycle leaning against the side wall of the café. At the sight of it, she thought how much it would change her life, ease her pain, to ride to town and back each day. Normally, a bicycle would be guarded by the soldiers in the café, but on this snow-dusted morning, no one was outside at a table. Don't do it. Her heart started beating quickly, her palms turned damp and hot within her mittens. She glanced around. The women queued up at the butcher's shop made it a point to see nothing and make eye contact with no one. The windows of the cafe across the street were fogged inside. The men were olive-hued silhouettes, so certain of themselves. Of us, she thought bitterly. At that, whatever sliver of restraint she possessed disappeared. She held the basket close to her side and limped out onto the ice-slick cobblestone street. From that second, that one step forward, the world seemed to blur around her and time slowed down. She heard her breath, saw the plumes of it in front of her face. The buildings blurred or faded into white hulks. The snow dazzled until all she could see was the glint of the silver handlebars and the two black tires. She knew there was only one way to do this, fast, without a glance sideways or a pause in her step. Somewhere a dog barked. A door banged shut. Isabel kept walking. Five steps separated her from the bicycle. Four, three, two. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.